Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
I was talking about the stuff that looking at memory in birds and stuff I did back in the 90s, and basically finding that the food stores, the chickadees, were paying a lot more attention to the spatial location than the array position, sort of the local spatial position, because it's right in the array, so you see the position. And then the color. They remembered everything, but they paid more attention. Or you might almost say, if you want to use terms from learning, if you took learning last term, that space overshadowed color. I did the same sort of thing on a much smaller scale. Those things were run once a day. The birds were run once a day. Then I did it running them many times a day. Jeez. 40 trial sessions, three of them for each bird. So 120 trials a day on a computer touchscreen. So the birds would actually be presented with stimuli that they'd peck at. So they were rewarded in this case, in this experiment, for going to one place and not to another. Okay? They had different colored patches on the screen. So it's kind of the same. And then I'd switch the two colors around. So let's say it was a red one and a green one. They had to go to the green one, let's say, because it was showed them, you know, there was a dot on it, a black dot. They'd peck on that, they'd get some food, then they would disappear, they'd learn that very quickly. Then I'd switch to, say, the red and the green around and see where they go. Okay? The chickadees relied on space and the juncos didn't. The chickadees actually ignored the color completely. The juncos paid attention to both of them roughly equally. So it's the same kind of result, just on a much smaller scale with many, many more trials a day. When I directly tested them on color, the chickadees had real trouble remembering where anything about color. I could teach them, but it took an inordinately long time. They just typically didn't respond to color.
Dave,
yes?
What did the juncos do? Did they rely more on color than space?
No, equally. Equally, yeah. You split it up.
So you separated, or you mixed around the color and the space, and some were going to, like, say, green, like
those
trained green, and some were going to the
spatial
location?
No, within each bird it was equal.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a good question. I got that question on my PhD already. From Marcy Spetch, University of Alberta. Functionally, this makes a lot of sense, so biologically, evolutionarily. Birds remember where something is, not what color it is. The food stores, right? Colors change, and this is especially true. Think about this, and also other, what we want to call local cues. Those things change during the winter. And that's maybe their story. So those things change. The line of trees over there is still there. So knowing that you stored something near that line of trees over there, that line of trees, unless you get a really bad, you know, hurricane, which don't happen much in the winter, earthquake, you know, get Afi takes over your country, whatever, these things are unlikely to happen, right? So it's much more stable. So that's what they respond to. The strange result really is the juncos, because frankly, relying on space and color equally is a weird thing. It sounds odd. In fact, it is odd. If you look at some other stuff that I did with a few of my old honor students back when I was a postdoc, Brodbeck, Flaubert, Vaughn, and Grant, 1997, we did the same thing with pigeons in a Skinner box, just showing them different colored lights, and they responded to space overwhelmingly rather than color. So the question is, why in the hell did I get this weird result? And this result, by the way, has been replicated in other pairs of storing and non-storing birds. With the pigeons, we actually just had three colors and three keys. It was an old-time Skinner box. So it might be that in that case, because color repeats itself so often, that maybe space was easier no matter what. It may also be the case that the kind of thing that I was doing with all many, many different colors and in many different spatial locations is a lot more like food sorting. So that's where I can find that difference. That's the only thing I can figure. I know that Nikki Clayton has replicated it with marsh tits and gray tits. I know that Al Campbell's group has replicated it with sorting and non-sorting corvids. So, I mean, it's a real result. It's actually called the Broadback effect. And I didn't name it, so there you go.
Dave.
Yeah.
Going back to the other stuff.
Yep.
Do they even do experiments like this with birds from, let's say, the tropics, where you don't have a real kind of winter?
Yeah, we thought about that. It's,
so would color be having an effect there? Perhaps.
Yeah, you see, we were thinking about, first of all, there's very few food stores in the tropics.
Yes.
Because they don't have, there's no environmental demand for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason where you don't see it that often. It may also be, we've thought about that, me and, actually me and Chris Sturdy, we're talking about this when we had a conference, Laurie Bloomfield's PhD supervisor. We threatened to do experiments together for years. And we had talked about this idea of doing something with tropical birds. The problem is getting them, first of all. Getting a permit to import tropical birds is expensive. Expensive time-wise, it can be done. And then you have to, when you release them, you have to release them back to where they belong.
That's the other thing.
Or you get killed. I don't really know what would happen.
I would think, even in the tropics, color is subject to change.
They do.
The flower one day, tomorrow I'm dead.
Yeah.
So
I would imagine, my guess is that you're going to get poorer cognitive performance of any sort based on, for any animal that lives in the tropics. Because they don't need to be so smart.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They just don't need for it. There's no real demand. I'm not saying every tropical animal is stupid. But what I'm saying is there is one titmouse that lives in like Panama or something, and it's a tropical one, and it doesn't migrate, but you don't have to migrate if you live in Panama. And we've talked about, that was the thing with Chris and I were talking about, was getting a hold of some of them and seeing what would happen. But it was one of these drunken conversations that Chris and I had that it was never going to go anywhere. I would imagine they would perform more like the juncos, but I think they'd also be more, they'd just perform more poorly in general. But that's just a gut feeling I have. I have nothing really to base that on. Because it's sort of a Just So story, but I'm telling you that. But yeah. No, that'd be cool. Other questions about that stuff? All right, I'm going to tell you about an experiment that I did a few years ago when I was at Memorial University. And it's Married for Space. Hello? What is this happening? It's going automatically here. Don't. That's annoying as hell. Oh, see, but if I do that. Okay. So that's the title. And I did it with Jessica Humber. This has been published now. It's actually now, I put her name first because I'm tenured and she's a graduate student. Seems like she needs publications more than me. So the published paper is by Humber, Broadbeck, and Workington. But we did some work on a species called pine siskins. And those are some pine, there's Jessica. And those are, let's go back. There we go, that works. Those are pine siskins. It's hard to really tell. By the way, they're like little finches. And they're weird animals. They migrate, but sometimes they go really far. They migrate. But every 10 years, 7, 10 years, they go way further south than they normally do. They make what they call migratory invasions of places like Mexico. They usually go only down as far as North Carolina. By the way, to show you what the weather was like, that picture was taken in June. Note the lack of tree leaves on the trees in Corderbrook, Newfoundland. So there's Jessica up there. Still have her data center. I don't know why I keep the data. We've published the paper. Let's just do that. Let it come in. No. This is annoying me. Okay, that somehow kind of sort of worked. No. Okay. Stay. Good. So, like I said, sometimes they'll go as far into Mexico when they get these migratory invasions. We decided to study them partially. Actually, Jessica got an NSERC student award, and I had a couple of summer inserts. They're great. You get money to do research. It's wonderful. And she needed to work with somebody who had a mensurk, so she came to me, and she was a biology student, and she knew nothing about my work, but there were only two people at that university that had NSERCs. It was me and a guy in astronomy, and she didn't know anything about astronomy. So she came to me, and I gave her a big pile of papers and books. I said, read this and come back in a week. And she came back in a week, and she designed this experiment. And it's basically based on the kind of stuff that I've been talking about. So you see, as you can see there, there's a little bit better picture of the birds themselves. So the first thing we decided to test, what's that? I don't know how that happened. Oh, no! I hate my computer right now. Actually, no, it's not my fault. You know whose fault it is? Microsoft. PowerPoint. The first thing we tested is if they could respond to different amounts of food. We figured they could, because if they're responding to a fluctuating food supply, when they make these migratory invasions, and that was the guess. The guess always was they would leave when the food was really bad. They would leave, go really far south, not just a little bit. So we put put feeders in her backyard, and you can see them here. There's the green feeder, and there's the red feeder, there's the yellow feeder, and we put seed in them there. I shouldn't say we, she did this, in a 3-to-2-to-1 ratio. Okay, so there's actually 3 cups of seed in here, 2 cups of seed in the red one, and 1 cup of seed in the yellow one. Now, they can learn this, and they learn it very quickly. Now, by the way, these aren't individual birds. This is just a flock of birds. These aren't banded or anything. They're just visits by birds to these feeders, okay? And she would look at these birds every morning at 10 o'clock and every afternoon at 2 o'clock for an hour and write down where they were visiting. And you can see that most of the visits, very quickly, they learned to go green, red, yellow. And we were pretty happy after 35 sessions, so 17 days that they were doing. So we were okay with that. We were pretty happy. So, of course, you know what we're going to do next is we're going to switch them around a bit. Let's do that, and then come back. So they certainly distinguished the feeders. This could be actually, they could be maybe seeing how much food was in each feeder. There were glass sort of walls on the side of them. They also could have gone, you know, emptied the rightmost feeder, which was the one with only 1 cup of seed first, so there's more food left, so that's where they're going 3-to-2-to-1. So who knows? So what we had to do was actually cover up the feeders. And does that, and we go back. So we covered them up, again, I should say she covered them up with cardboard on the inside so the birds couldn't see, and now we can tell where they're going. Are they going red, green, green, red, yellow? Is that just based on them actually seeing the amount of food, or are they remembering where the food was? And then we also started swapping them around, like I did in that work I talked about. So we swapped the green one with the red one, the yellow one with the green one, whatever. And you can see what happened. It's not so bad. So this is a standard day, right? Green, red, yellow. Here we swapped the yellow one with the red one. Now they're going green, yellow, red. Here we swapped the green one with the red one. Red, green, yellow. Here we swapped the green one with the yellow. Yes. Yellow, red, green, red. If you notice what they're doing there with all those examples is they're still using the spatial information. They're going to the leftmost feeder, then the middle feeder, then the right feeder. Okay? The bottom ones are really weird. They're responding equally. And statistically, it is equally if you do a chi-squared on this. These ones actually look almost exactly equal. This one looks like the red one's a little high. It's not statistically different. So as long as we didn't take the green one, which is the most profitable feeder, that was in the left-hand side, and move it all the way over to the right, they followed the space. The interesting thing is, when we did that, when we took a really good feeder and put it in exactly the wrong position, the birds were treating it like it was a brand new world, right? oh, I don't know what this is like anymore. That can't, that's not supposed to be there. And they just randomly went to the three different kinds of theaters. So what's this mean?
Well, I have no idea.
No. Like I said here, the Franciscans responded based on space, sort of. So, only when the most profitable theater was in the left or middle position. So it's like they formed a multidimensional representation, as we say in memory, right? But they basically treated it as brand new if it was so completely off. So you can see you can even do this kind of stuff in the field. And as this was a conference talk, I always thank my students and my family. And that's from Cornerbrook, and that's Craig Keynes. He's now a school teacher. And oh, we're going back, because I want to tell you about these really interesting people. And that's Eric Legg on the right. Hard to see Eric. Eric is now a PhD student at the University of Alberta. And those are my kids back then, and that is Cornerbrook, Newfoundland. And that's what snow looks. You don't know, see, I've said it before, you know what snow is. Look at the size of that snowbank. Okay? That's our house. And that's not some trick angle. I just stood across the street and took a picture. You people don't know what snow is. They don't know what cold is. You don't know what snow is. All right. When we look at mental memory in general, we can talk about working memory and reference memory. You know, let's think, working memory, is that going to be like phonological loop? And no. And visual, spatial, no. It's a different term. It's roughly the same idea because it tends to be sort of a short-term thing. But what it is it's the memory needed to solve one trial of a task. One trial of a task. Okay? So if an animal's running on a maze and it's been down one arm, it's like, I don't go back to that arm because I've already been there. That's working memory. Reference memory are the rules of the game. So that's like, I know that this arm, well, were my Franciscans there for our Franciscans? I know that the rule would be, the reference memory portion of that is, left, middle, right is 3-2-1. Right? So that's the distinction. One of them is about rules. And it, you tend to kind of think of it as long-term memory. It doesn't have to be. And working memory is solving an individual trial. All right. So one of the things we can use to study animal memory in general is something called matching to sample. And in matching to sample, you guys took learning all about this, I can show a pigeon, let's say, a lighted disc, which is called a key, and it would be, say, red, and then I can show it, then it goes out. It pecks at this and it goes away. And then I give it a choice between a red key and a green key. The pigeon's task is to match to sample. In other words, it has to now again peck the red key. Next trial, it might be a green key, and then it gets a choice between red and green. And yes, half the time it's red, and half the time it's green, and half the time red's on the left, and half the time green's on the left. We are obsessed with methodology, we psychologists. And I have to. So in that case, what's the working memory part of this experiment is remembering what color you just saw. Right? The reference memory part of it, you know, so you can complete the so you can pick the right one, so you can match to sample. The reference memory part is, well, there's two ways you could actually solve this. With the reference memory part could be, if red peck red, if green peck green. Or you could just use one thing, and that is match to sample. In other words, always match the color that I just saw. But one of them is a set of rules that applies to every trial. The next one, working memory, which is I just saw red or I just saw green. That is the working memory. And that'll change trial by trial. You can also do delayed non-matching example. So when it's red, you pick green. This is one of those places where the qualitative, quantitative differences show up. McIntosh, Wilson, and Boaks in 1982 did a really awesome, super awesome, cool experiment. What they did is they had pigeons and jackdaws. Jackdaws are pretty, always started being pretty smart birds. Pigeons are, believe me, I've worked with pigeons for years, they're just stupid. I shouldn't say that. They aren't that interesting. Anyway, what they did is they trained them up just like this, except instead of matching two samples, don't match the sample, right? And they did matching two samples. So that was theirs was if red peck red, if green peck green. That was what the birds were learning. Or maybe they were learning match to sample. Both pigeons and jackdaws got really good at this really quickly. Which isn't surprising, it's not that hard a task. Then what they did is they switched it around. They used blue or yellow samples, and then of course the choices are between blue and yellow. If the reference memory that the birds had was if red peck red, if yellow, if green peck green, when you switch around to blue and yellow, they should be horrible. Right? Because it's like there's no red or green. What do I do? On the other hand, if they're remembering the rule of match to sample, it shouldn't bother them the least. Huh, blue. I haven't seen that before, but I know I'm supposed to match to sample. With the pigeons, when you switched around to blue and yellow, they got the 50%, going from like 85% down to 50%. They don't have the chance. Showing what the pigeons are remembering is if red peck red, if green peck green. The jackdaws, they went down a little bit, but hardly at all, and they were still low above chance, showing that the jackdaws had remembered to match to sample. So there's a qualitative difference. They're both solving the task. And of course, in nature, it doesn't matter how you solve the task, as long as you solve it. But the interesting question for the psychologist is, how are you solving this task? It's a qualitative difference. They're doing it in a different way. And in fact, that was the paper that I read that inspired me to develop the paradigm I came up with. Does that make sense? That's what McIntosh Wilson books on. Beautiful paper. Nick McIntosh is a smart man. Those are both books, actually. I can't remember who the Wilson is. Both delayed matching sample and delayed non-matching sample are subject to proactive and retroactive interference, just like we talked about. Remember, we talked about interference, and I mean, Ebbinghaus talked about interference. So we see exactly the same kind of phenomena, these kind of phenomena, in matching a sample, as we do in human memory for lists of words. Now, this is a neat experiment, and those of you guys who took learning know about this. You can also do what's called symbolic matching. And in this experiment, red, orange, and was it green or was it blue? It doesn't really matter, does it? I think it was blue. The birds can either be presented with a red key, an orange key, or a blue key. And if the sample was red, it was a horizontal line. It was a vertical line. If it was orange, it was a horizontal line. If it was blue, it was an almost vertical line. So in other words, if they would get red as the sample, then they get a choice between a vertical line and a horizontal line. You have to pick vertical because red means vertical. Okay? Do you understand the paradigm? Because if you don't understand the paradigm, the results aren't going to be interesting. See, this works. I know you guys are learning about this experiment. Okay. So the question is, how are pigeons doing a matching task? Well, this is called symbolic matching task. Are they remembering what they saw? In other words, a retrospective encoding. In other words, I saw red, I saw red, I saw red. Or are they remembering pick vertical, pick vertical, pick vertical? And you might think that's a very hard thing to determine when you're talking to a pigeon. In fact, it'd be hard to determine if I asked you something. If I gave you a list of words and I said one of the words was tree, are you saying, I'm going to say tree, going to say tree, or do you think back, was it tree? That's a hard thing you can do with people. This is Herb Reuchlatt's PhD thesis, if I'm not mistaken. Very clever experiment. So what he does is let's say he gives him a red sample, and then he has them choose between vertical and almost vertical. If they're doing this retrospectively, in other words, I saw red, that's easy, right? Because red means vertical. If they're doing it prospectively, they could confuse vertical and almost vertical. On the other hand, if you give them blue, no, let's say you give them red again, but then they get a choice between vertical and horizontal, if they're encoding retrospectively, thinking back, it was red, it was red, it was red, if they're trying to remember what it was, the choice between vertical and horizontal is hard. Why? Because red and orange are very similar colors. Right? So you understand that? It's exceedingly clever. Okay. So what happened? Well, he did the experiment and he started pulling the retention interval out between the color and then the choices. And at first, they were encoding retrospectively, and then when you make the retention interval longer, they start to use prospective encoding. And that actually makes a great deal of sort of functional sense, doesn't it? When it's easy to remember what the original sample was, when the short retention interval is very short, use that. Right? When it gets longer, so it gets harder, the retention interval is longer, it gets harder, start thinking about what I've got to do in the future. Instead of the past, instead of what I saw. It's a very clever experiment. Make sense? You get the results? This is one of the hardest experiments. I remember when I read this in graduate school, I remember reading it going, I don't know what happened here. So don't feel bad if you don't get it, but if you don't get it, ask me, I'll try to explain it to you. So.
Can I just try to get this straight?
Yep.
Okay, so if you give the bird a red key,
yep,
and then you give them the choice of either a horizontal line or a completely vertical line,
yep,
and they pick the vertical line, that means they are messing up the red and orange, so they're encoding retrospectively.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then if you give them, let's say, a blue key, and you have the horizontal and almost vertical,
yeah,
and they pick the horizontal,
yeah,
that means they're...
No, you mean a blue key... And the horizontal and the vertical and the almost vertical.
Yeah, vertical and almost vertical.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because again, those are easily confused. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, they don't start choosing only one of them. They just go down the chance. They go down to 50% if they're screwing it. Because if they went the other way, they would tell you something. They're remembering something and doing it wrong. Right.
Dave,
If I'm not mistaken, come on, I'm sorry, I think it starts around 5 seconds for most of the birds.
For jackals?
No, this is pigeons. This is pigeons. It's an exceedingly clever piece of work. Jeez. It's one of those experiments where you think, I wish I would have thought of that one. See, I'm fingertips of all my colleagues in animal cognition are all going to Florida. I see my Facebook status, everybody with their students in their car driving to Florida, going on the plane, going to Florida, and I'm here with you, Laura. Yeah. Hello. Goodness, like, Florida, I just get sunburned, right? I mean... No, seriously. It's like, oh, great. It's hot out. Everybody else is like, oh, it's so great. You know, my friend's like from Edmonton. It was minus 38 when I left. Yeah, it was minus 15 when I left, and now I have sunstroke. I'd rather it was minus 15, thank you. Right next to the hotel, though, we have this thing. There's a biker bar, and it's awesome. So it's fun. Suddenly a whole bunch of graduate students and faculty members are walking around a biker bar. We tip well, so all the bartenders always know us. The bartender at the hotel, I hadn't been to the conference in 4 years. I showed him, he goes, hey, it's Dave from Canada. I said, why didn't you? He said, well, first of all, you spent a lot of time in this bar. I am me. He said, and you tip well. You guys all tip so well. That's when I snuck into a wedding with that, when I was at that conference, because it's a big hotel. Somebody had their wedding at that conference. So I looked at my Shannon, who was one of Sarah's graduate students at the time. And I was a prof at the time, but I said, he said, what's going on there? I said, it looks like a wedding. Want to go? He said, you can't go to a wedding. I said, you've never crashed a wedding? It's trivial. You just walk in. He said, what do I do? I said, you follow my lead. Don't worry. We just walked in. We're wearing shorts and sandals and t-shirts and ball caps. Everybody else has like tuxes on. So we walk in, and he says, I walk up to the bar. And a guy looks at me and goes, who are you with? I said, oh, Uncle Hazard is there. And of course, there's live music and everything. He goes, oh, yeah, how's he doing? I said, he's great. Says hello. So I said, we each want 5 beers. Because it was an open bar, right? And it's the bartender that we know. He looks, what the hell are you guys doing here? You can't be here so well. You know, so we drank our 5 beers really quickly. And we left. And then I ran into the guy that said hello to me on the elevator. He said, and they were like Seinfeld's parents. It was so art. They were like the archetypal Jewish New Yorker people that live in Florida, like you see on Seinfeld. He said, so you weren't really with the wedding, were you? I said, no, we were just. And the woman looks over at his wife, I imagine, says, are you with that brain thing? And I said, yeah, we're with the brain thing, the conference that's going on. Are you a doctor? I said, yeah, of a sort. You know, I said, and I'm married. Because I know she was going to introduce me to her daughter. But it was like I was in the Seinfeld. It was great. That has nothing to do with the course, but I love that story. This is Herb's experiment. Symbolic matching. Red is horizontal. Orange is vertical. Blue is almost vertical. Did I get that right? Yeah, I did. Oh, no, I haven't switched around. If they make mistakes when the choices are 1 and 2, they're encoding retrospectively. If they do it when the choices are 2 and 3, they're doing prospectively. And what they did is they said it's dynamic. This is the really cool thing about this. It shows that it's a dynamic process. That memory, even in animals, is something that the animal has to be paying attention to. Right? And you don't tend to think about that. You tend to think, and I know you guys took learning, realize that it's not this way. But we tend to think of animals, when they remember things, as being like these passive objects. Kind of like the way we think of little kids or babies. Right? When they're learning, we don't tend to think that kids are actually using encoding strategies, do we? Right? Even though, if we could think back a little bit to when we were kids, we would remember that we probably used encoding strategies. But even infants use encoding strategies. And the same thing happens with pigeons. So memory is an active process. Right? And you can see here, it's almost like it's reconstructive memory in some respects, too, that the pigeons are doing, which is very cool. But think about how this compares, again, with human stuff. You think about reconstructive notions of memory. Memory is an active process. We, with our flashbulb memories, we rebuild memories. And memories that actually aren't memories. Right? So they're not that different from us in some fundamental respects. They're different in a lot of other respects, obviously. Eight-arm radial maze is something that we've talked about, or I've talked about in learning. And some of you guys I know are doing animal memory papers. It's an a maze that has eight arms radiating out like the spokes of a wheel. That's not a very good looking one. But you put food at the end to say four arms, one there, let's say one there. Put the rat in there. He goes to the four arms that have food, and he doesn't go to the arms that don't have food. And that's, remember, that's the reference memory part is what arms have food? What arms don't have food? The working memory part is, have I been down this arm before? Now, something neat, and I said we talked about this in learning, Suzuki et al., not David Suzuki, Suzuki Argyrinos and Black, had different, like, cues at the end of each arm. I'm running out of ideas for shapes. It's kind of a threat. Anyway, and a bunch of others. Because the question was, are they remembering I went down the one with the pentagon? Or are they remembering I went down in this spatial location? Went down that arm. So what they did is halfway through the rats running the maze, they stopped them. And they either moved all the cues around randomly, or they just rotated the whole set of cues. Okay? If they move all the cues around randomly, the rats don't know what to do. If they rotate them all, let's say 90 degrees, or 180 degrees, whatever, the rats now change where they're going to visit based on what the relationship of all of the cues to each other say. To go down. So, like, if you moved all these, and by my diagram here, it looks like the one with the diamond shape here would have been a baited cue, a baited arm, rather. If you rotate this whole thing down to, say, here, right, and, the, and now you have it all completely all around here, they maybe go down this arm, thinking that was the one that was one of the baited arms. But if you just move them around and just take this one and put it over here, they ignore it. Or they don't know what to do, they just want a chance. What this shows is that they have like a map, a cognitive map, a spatial representation. I think that's cool too. McCune and Roberts, 1997, found the rat's chunk. We talked about chunking, right? So, they had a 12-arm maze. Bill Roberts is big on making radial mazes that have more arms than... Something he's always done. I don't know why. He had a 31-arm maze once. 17-arm maze. Like, weird odd numbers, too. He's a very bright man. I did my postdoc with Bill, but he always had these weird mazes sitting around the lab. He had one that was like eight arms and then four arms coming off each of the eight arms. It's weird. Anyway... That was a good reason, though. So yeah, 12-arm maze. And there were three kinds of food. There was Cocoa Puffs. I think it was Cocoa Puffs or Count Chocula, one or the other. We use a lot of Count Chocula in his lab. Rats love sugar, and they love chocolate. So children's breakfast cereal. And then a piece of cheese. Also, rat pellets, which are these little ugly, non-tasty things for rats. They'll eat them, but they don't like them. So, what he did, what Todd McCune and Bill Roberts did, is they would be in the same place each day, right? The chocolate ones, and then the cheese ones, and then the noise pellets, the Noise, N-O-Y-E-S, that's who makes them. I'm going to say noise pellets. That's the company that makes those things. So they had these. What do the rats do? They very quickly learn where all the different kinds of food were. So they've got the chocolate arms, and the cheese arms, and the noise pellet arms. Well, does that show chunking? Well, it sort of does, but it's not... It's kind of weak, in a way. It indicates that they might be chunking. They might go to chocolate first, then go to cheese, then go to noise pellets. Next thing they did is they randomly moved all the... Or for one group, rather, they just randomly switched all the food types. The rats, of course, were fine for memory, but they didn't show any preferences. When they instead switched, say, noise pellets with the chocolate cereal, the rats would go get one, what was supposed to be chocolate cereal arm, and get a noise pellet, run back to the middle, and then go down all the old noise pellet arms. They switched noise pellets. It's like the rats going, oh, he switched the pellets with the chocolate. I know. That must mean I should go down all the pellet arms because those are now chocolate arms. That's a cool experiment. You got noise pellets in my chocolate. No, you got chocolate in my noise pellets. And it's delicious. It's an old ad for Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Very old ad. You get so many pop culture references there from well before you were born. It's good. That's a neat experiment. I don't know why I keep having exclamation points here. Well, I think this stuff excites the crap out of me, but I know probably not you. Peter Trolley, who's one of those people on Facebook that's going to that conference, did some really neat stuff that's directly forgetting. In humans, if I'm giving you a list of words, and one of the words is, again, tree, but I say forget, you will actually forget the word tree. You won't, because I just told you, I'm not gonna test you on the word tree. Right? And then if I say telephone, remember. You'll do really well on the remember ones and really poorly on the forget ones. Because, you know, sometimes I screw with you and I test you on the ones I said I wasn't going to test you on. The forget ones. Well, direct and forget. It works really well. Same thing happens in pigeons. Using matching sample. You show them a sample, but then you give them a signal that says, I'm not going to test you. Or another signal that says, oh, you're going to be tested on this. So, you know, a green light and then maybe a triangle for I'm not going to test you and a square for I'm going to test you or something like that. Turns out pigeons can be directed to forget something. So, again, they're actively participating in their own memory. And this is one of my favorites, and I talked about this again in learning, is Inman and Shuttleworth's experiment on metamemory in pigeons. And what Alistair Inman and Sarah Shuttleworth did in this experiment is, now you know what metamemory is in people, we talked about that. When I talked about, early on in the course, I talked about the tip of the tongue phenomenon, right? And I said that sometimes you know something, you're aware of the contents of your own memory. So, are pigeons aware of their own memories? So, they trained them up such that if they got, say, a red key, and then they could take either a choice between, and I can't remember what the signal was, but let's say it was a triangle, and they'd get some food. Okay? But if they pecked instead at the square, and I don't think it was a square, it might have been a different orientations of lines, doesn't matter. And then a choice between a red key and a green key, they get like, it wasn't five, I can't remember. That would make sense. I think it was two times the food. Yeah. So they get food here, but if they pecked into the test, they'd get twice as much food if they got it right. But if they pecked the safe key, which in this case is the triangle, they'd get some food. In other words, you have to ask the pigeon, do you remember what you just saw? Because if you do, you're going to... And they learn this. They learn to do this. And then you screw with them. On some test days, when they kick the safe key, you give the test anyway. And what happens? The pigeons don't do as well. Right? Now, that's pretty indicative that they know what's in their own memories. Right? They must. But if it was true that they can't, that this really is about their own, with knowing their contents, their own memories, it would make sense that the longer you make the retention interval, right, the time between study and test, the longer you make that, the more likely they should choose the safe key. Because you're going to forget. Right? If I asked you to put money on something, and it was, you know, and I said, are you going to bet that you can remember something you learned in grade 9, whatever. You know, how to do, factory polynomials. Right? And assuming, which is something you all did in grade 9, you might remember how to do it, but you did it. If I said, I'll give you $100 if you can do 20 of those in 5 minutes, or I'll just give you $10, you can just take the safe option. So from grade 9, you go, I'll take the $10, because I'm not going to get the 100. Right? On the other hand, if I was something that you did last term, or let's say this term, some of you taking statistics, to do a Z test. Don't move the Z test. Never move the normal distribution. We need no hissing of the normal distribution or any other statistical test. Well, you think, well, that's probably pretty easy. I'll take that one. Because you would know you could do it. Which is, by the way, way easier than factoring polynomials. This happened. They started choosing a safe key more as Alistair and Sarah pulled your attention over the lab. But it also was the case that they also really didn't know the contents of their own memory. Because the more when they started doing that a whole bunch, taking the safe key, when they were tested anyway, they were right around chance. It's a very, very cool experiment. It is so clever. I was there when Alistair thought of it, because he was a postdoc in Sarah's lab and I was a grad student still. And he was explaining this, and he thought it was something like foraging or something, because he's a biologist. And we all went, dude, meta-memory in pigeons! And he's like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Because he was thinking about foraging theory and all that stuff. To learn more about foraging theory, take Psychology 3106, Animal Behavior, next year. I just like to do a plug now and then. I do a plug. I like plugging. You even look at priming. And this is a complicated experiment that I'm not going to go into great detail of explaining. Because it's hard. I did it in learning, and it makes a little more sense to explain the whole experiment there. I'm not really going to do it there. Suffice it to say, what I did and what me and Craig Keynes did later on is we, you know, like word fragment completion in humans? So if I give you C blank F F blank E, you're more likely to fill it with coffee, the word coffee. If you'd seen the word coffee previously, right? I did the same thing, and so did Craig and I, with pigeons identifying pictures. So we'd show them a picture, and then we'd show them a picture fragment. And unlike matching the sample, which in about 10 seconds disappears. The pigeons are horrible at that in 10 seconds. Craig Keynes, in his honors thesis with me, ended up getting pigeons to do this out to 3 minutes. Just like how priming in humans lasts an exceedingly long time. Remember Tolkien, Schachter, and Stark, right? If you really want to know how that experiment works in every detail, if you go up on the fifth floor, all of us on the fifth floor, everything we've ever published, we hang up. Because I believe we all have gargantuan egos. No, it's to show that we're all, working scientists and what have you. So it's up there, it's called picture fragment completion, priming in the print pigeon. Okay? Go read it. It's really a complicated experiment. So I'm not going to go through how I did it. It was sensible to talk about how I did in the learning, but not here. Suffice to say, it was picture fragment completion, not word fragment completion. So basically, the point of all this animal memory stuff is that there are things that are completely different about certain animals and us. Right? So the food-storing birds like the Clark's Nutcracker that hide 30,000 seeds in the fall, and there are 25,000 or more 6 months later. That's something none of us can do. And that's because of evolutionary pressures that are on them that aren't on us. On the other hand, there's stuff that we all do the same. We all show meta-memory. I'm guessing that other species do, too. That hasn't been tested a lot. It's been tested a lot of apes, obviously, humans, now pigeons. Priming is something, implicit memory. Priming, implicit memory should show up almost everywhere. According to Tulbing, he told me he thought it would happen in every animal. Because, first of all, he believes that all animal memory is implicit. But also, it should be evolutionarily old to recognize a degraded stimulus, something you've seen before. When you're, say, hunting for food, if you're a bird looking for a cryptic colored moth. The idea of rehearsal and directed forgetting and prospective and retrospective encoding, those are things that should go with all of us, not just the humans, but all kinds of other animals. So there are going to be specializations, and we can't ignore them, and we have to look at the biological function of things, but also there will be generalities. I know, because I remember when I started talking about this stuff, I said, you know, can animals do what people do with a stupid question? And, you know, and that's something I was trained that way. That's what Sarah Shuttleworth taught me to do. And then I told her what I was doing with my postdoc, which was priming of implicit memory in pigeons. And she said, does anybody ever look at you and say, aren't you a Sarah Shuttleworth PhD? And I say, yeah, but there are things that we should all do. And she said, no, you're right. That makes complete sense. So the point of this stuff, like I said, was just to show you that there are similarities and differences, and we can't ignore any of them. And the neat thing here is, unlike with people, you cannot just take a bird and say, here's a list of words, can you remember those? You have to do what you do with, say, infants or very young children and design really clever experiments. So it seems to me that people that do animal memory research are smarter than people that do human memory research. I mean, I've done both. But most of my stuff's animal stuff. Questions about that stuff? All right, on Monday, we will do a review, and I'll talk about the test. I'll have some concluding remarks, what the big themes were, that kind of thing. And then we'll talk a little bit about the upcoming test. Well, I got a hard path when you take a cab. Just a one more drink, I think I'm gonna sing. Well, I got I'll see you.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.